Ohio troopers will work with Cincinnati police to reduce crime. Does this mean the National Guard could be next? This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, we discuss the latest efforts to reduce crime in Cincinnati. New spending on public safety, a new ordinance to protect tenants, the new U.S. attorney for Southern Ohio, and how preserving a local watershed is helping undo damage from the old Fernald nuclear site. Joining me now to get the news review started are Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Patricia Gallagher Newberry and WVXU General Assignment reporter Nick Sportzell. Welcome back, Patty and Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Happy to be here.
Great to have you both. Nick, Governor DeWine was in town this week. Tell us about the announcement he made with Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Pierbal.
Sure. The two were at City Hall for a news conference about expanding the role that Ohio State Highway Patrol plays in sort of law enforcement activities in the city of Cincinnati. There were some other things that we'll get to that they talked about during that news conference as well, but that was kind of the overall big news item, is that the Highway Patrol is going to do a little bit more than they've been doing.
And Nick, what are some of the ways the State Highway Patrol will be helping Cincinnati police officers?
So in a memorandum of understanding between the city and the state of Ohio, basically what's laid out is that roughly two times a month, Ohio State troopers will help Cincinnati police with what they call joint enforcement operations. And the way DeWine and Pierbal talked about this is that these are going to be highly targeted based on, intelligence that CPD has gathered and that state investigators have gathered about kind of the worst, quote unquote, according to DeWine, offenders who are currently kind of out and about allegedly committing crimes.
Yeah. Patty, hasn't the State Highway Patrol already been helping in some ways? What have they been doing?
Right. The governor offered the help just after the so-called brawl happened in downtown Cincinnati on July 26. And at that time, officers from the Highway Patrol were assigned to patrol Interstate 71 and 75 in the greater Cincinnati area, thereby freeing up CPD officers to concentrate on city streets, downtown, over the Rhine in particular.
And it was this big fight in late July that you mentioned that kind of triggered this offer of help from the governor?
Right. As I'm sure your listeners know, it set off quite a firestorm in Cincinnati and around the country as the video of that went viral. And Cincinnati all of a sudden was, in the spotlight as this crime-ridden city where we've got to get it under control. And city leaders really have responded on many fronts. And now this week, the state offering additional resources.
Nick, tell us about the special task force to apprehend violent fugitives that came up at this news conference.
Sure. This is a separate initiative that is headed up by the U.S. Marshals. So now we're bringing federal law enforcement partners into this. And it's called the Southern Ohio Fugitive Apprehension Strike Team, or SOFAST. I imagine they arranged those letters to get that clever acronym. It's made of the Ohio State Highway Patrol, the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections, Adult Parole Authority, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of Ohio, and other local and state agencies play a role in this too, including now the city of Cincinnati. And so they are also kind of going after fugitives, people who are already warranted for arrest or maybe they've violated their parole, who are accused of crimes like arson, burglary, sexual assault, murder, those kind of things.
Has it gotten any results?
According to DeWine, yes. He says about a dozen folks have already been apprehended in the Cincinnati-specific operation that this task force does, which I think is called a Queen City project or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Patty, is there any ambiguity over who will be in charge during this partnership between Cincinnati Police and the State Highway Patrol?
The governor made clear that Cincinnati will have the upper hand. In fact, we quoted him directly saying, Cincinnati Police are in charge. And the memorandum of understanding makes clear that they were going to be making the operational decisions as to when, where, how, who will be involved in these special joint operation enforcement actions.
And so will the average citizen notice this extra police presence?
I believe the police chief said something like, you'll notice if you're a criminal that there might be additional policing, but if you're just a regular Joe going about your business, you shouldn't really notice. It's not as though there, every street's going to be clogged with highway patrol cars or additional police officers.
Mm-hmm. Nick, how long is this partnership designed to last?
So I believe there is an expiration date in the MOU, I think, at the end of this year. But when asked, DeWine said, we are willing to be here as long as the city wants us to be here and as long as it seems necessary. So, you know, that could be extended, I think. Hmm.
Patty, the National Guard came up during this news conference. What did the governor say about the National Guard?
Well, not a whole lot. So one of our reporters, my colleague Cameron Knight, asked the question during the press conference about the National Guard. And his actual question was, can you talk a little bit about the prospect of the National Guard coming into cities like Cincinnati? This is, of course, playing off the fact that the Trump administration has been deploying the Guard in other places that it identifies as high crime, where there's a belief that the local law enforcement isn't doing its job sufficiently. So Cam asked that question, and he asked, excuse me, a follow-up question that said, is the state-city partnership a way to stop that from happening, that being National Guard? And so the governor chose not to answer the National Guard part, but instead just talked about the highway patrol and, you know, answered, well, it's being done, in his mind, the highway patrol is being done to save lives, to fight crimes, to have fewer victims, to go after criminals and so forth. And so he didn't really answer the question about the National Guard. We did a follow-up on that. The mayor very clearly wants the National Guard.
Yeah,
we're getting to that, I know.
Mayor, yeah.
But Mike DeWine did not say anything. But I think also your listeners are probably aware that Ohio did send the Guard into Washington, D.C. at the request of the Trump administration. We have 150 Ohio Guard folks there, and they're going to stay through the end of November.
Well, the mayor responded, as Patty noted, much more directly.
If I could weigh in on that question as well. You know, from the city's perspective, there is absolutely no reason to even consider sending in the National Guard to Cincinnati. Not only would it be a massive waste of resources, but it would ultimately make our city less safe. I'm proud to be partnering with the governor to actually make our city safe by giving us the resources and the manpower to continue to crack down on violent criminals through enforcement. That's exactly why we're here. Because of that collaboration, because of that partnership, ultimately Cincinnati will be safer.
Nick, do the mayor and police chief seem happy about having this help from state troopers?
I think in this news conference, they celebrated partnerships. They said, you know, we this is how law enforcement works. We collaborate with all these other groups all the time, and then this is just kind of a new way of doing so, or these are new ways of doing so. You know, there might have been some back and forth behind the scenes about what exactly the MOU contains and the parameters of it. The mayor, he highlighted the fact that the MOU contains language about the collaborative agreement, and that's going to be respected, and that, like, you know, Ohio State troopers are going to have a whole training about the collaborative. So I think there was maybe some give and take about this, but they are at least in public saying, yes, this is a good thing.
Well, Nick, the city's taking other steps to try to reduce crime. We talked last week with our colleague Becca Costello about how city council was looking to spend more money on public safety. What did council do this week?
So this week in council, they approved $5.4 million more to spend on public safety. Some of that money was already kind of put in a pool. About $2 million of it was put in a pool earlier that would be used for some kind of public safety, and it was appropriated. And then $3.4 million, you know, you do the math, was kind of like newly added from a contingency fund. And that money is going to go toward police overtime and visibility efforts, like a big chunk, about $1.2 million of it. There's going to be some technology upgrades, including expansion of the drone program the CPD just launched. And then there's going to be some other kind of like violence prevention funding as well.
I know that funding for curfew centers is part of that, too. Can you explain what the curfew centers are for and how much they've been used so far?
Sure. So these are for young people who are caught out after curfew in the city, which was instituted to kind of like stem some of this public safety issue we've been having. There are two. One's in the West End, one's in Coryville. And they are there for young people whose family doesn't come pick them up immediately or something like that. It's kind of an alternative to arrest and putting them in the juvenile center or something like that. So far, no one has been taken to those, according to the city. They haven't had to enforce curfew in that way yet.
Okay. Nick, was there any opposition to this added funding or this ordinance on council?
Yes. Vice Mayor Jean-Michel Lemon-Kearney and a couple of other council members, Scotty Johnson and Victoria Parks, they were like pretty concerned about A, the focus on downtown and over the Rhine, and B, the lack of funding for kind of long-term violence prevention efforts. That would be like youth employment programs, other things to kind of like address trauma, that kind of thing. And they were saying like, we need to spend that kind of money now on these long-term programs. So they voted against this particular funding package.
Where will this money come from? And is there any chance that the city won't spend it all?
So this money comes from this reserve fund that the city sets aside every year when they do their budget carryover. And it's kind of like a rainy day fund, more or less. The money for police overtime and visibility, if CPD doesn't spend all of that on overtime at the end of the year, it can be rolled over to other public safety, functions in the new year.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned these kind of longer term strategies, trauma, those sorts of things, and that Vice Mayor Jean-Michel Lemon-Kearney and a couple other council members said, hey, why aren't we spending money on this? Was there much response from other council members about that? I mean, how did they respond to those concerns?
Yeah, I think all the members of council agreed we need to do those things. But it was the kind of like, we're going to do a yes and approach, right? Which is a pretty classic thing for politicians to say, even if they mean it. I think what they were saying is like, this is the emergency right now. We have this sort of like perception, at least, that the city's not safe. Although several council members pointed out that crime data is nuanced and not 100%, increasing all the time. But they said, we can get to these other things over time. Right now, we're just trying to address the immediate issue of violent crime.
Yeah. What are you all going to be watching next with all of this when it comes to these, I don't know if your things you're keeping an eye on with this MOU, this agreement between the city and the Highway Patrol, or just public safety generally?
I am really interested in the sort of like federal partnerships and how the federal law enforcement agencies that are located here continue to get involved in local law enforcement. The U.S. attorney for the district was at this news conference and said, we care about local crime, we care about street level crime. How that plays out, especially given sort of Kash Patel from the FBI was, head of the FBI was in Cincinnati recently to talk about a fentanyl bust, right? Like, how does federal focus on the region pan out, and what does that mean, for other things that can happen?
I'd like to see if the city is going to be announcing some high-level arrests, completion of these joint operations. If you've got this additional backup from the state of Ohio, what does that really look like? Are we going to have some additional people, especially, for example, parole violations. We've had some, high-profile cases of parolees breaking their ankle bracelet and committing additional crimes. And, are we going to see some of those folks taken off the street? And will the city be very public about that?
Well, and coming up this Tuesday, the city manager is going to join us to discuss quality of life issues and crime, so our listeners have that to look forward to. I've been talking with Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Patricia Gallagher-Newberry and WVXU General Assignment reporter Nick Swartzel. Thank you both so much for your time today.
Thanks, Lucy.
You bet.
We want to give you a heads up on a special opportunity to watch our show live. Coming up September 24th at 8 p.m., join us for a live discussion about election issues in our event space. RSVP at WVXU.org. And up next, we'll hear about the new U.S. Attorney for Southern Ohio and the role he could play in public safety. And we're actually going to get Nick Swartzel to stick around a little bit longer. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. There's a new U.S. attorney for Southern Ohio. How could his office help reduce violent crime in the region? Joining me to discuss that is WCPO9 I-Team reporter Paula Christian. Thanks for being here, Paula.
Thanks for having me, Lucy.
Paula, we were just talking about this partnership between Cincinnati Police and the State Highway Patrol to reduce crime in Cincinnati. What role could federal agents and prosecutors play in those efforts?
Well, there's so many local crimes that can be prosecuted at the federal level. Anytime you have a felon with a gun, anytime you have somebody who's entered the country illegally with a gun, if you have a gun that's been altered so that it becomes more of a high-powered rifle, any of those things can be prosecuted federally as gun crimes. You know, there's a long list of ways that federal prosecutors and agents can take local street crimes federal, which have much stricter penalties, much longer prison terms, a dramatically higher conviction rate. Federal prosecutors win, I think, in excess of 95% of their cases. And so in addition, also, if you have drug enterprises, if you have drugs that are being dealt on the street, but they're coming from, you know, Mexico or Central America or even other states, that can be prosecuted as a drug enterprise, a criminal enterprise. So there's so many options.
Tell us about this new U.S. attorney for Southern Ohio and about some of the high-profile criminal cases he's announced so far.
Well, Dominic Gerace, he worked as a line prosecutor under former U.S. Attorney Ben Glassman, and then he worked as a supervisor in the Dayton office under former U.S. Attorney Dave DeVillers. He kind of has a specialty in white-collar crime, in counterintelligence, national security-type cases. The two former U.S. attorneys I spoke to do predict that he will want to take bigger, more national, international-level cases just because he has the expertise and the interest. You know, but so far, he did take two of the people who were involved in the street brawl in July, two of those people that were charged at the county level for their involvement. He took both of those at the federal level. He's also prosecuting a children's hospital doctor or former doctor for alleged child pornography crimes as well. He's taken on some illegal immigrant cases. So he is doing a lot. He was appointed and sworn in, you know, less than a month ago. So it's important to remember a lot of these cases started before he was even U.S. attorney, but certainly the two downtown brawl cases were under his direction.
You mentioned that you talked to a couple of former U.S. attorneys. One of them was Ben Glassman. Did he say anything more specifically about the kinds of cases he expects to see prosecuted?
He very much thinks that Dominic will be looking at high-level cases. He said that there's kind of two ways that a U.S. attorney can take their job. They can just prosecute the cases that come their way, which is typically drugs and, you know, somewhat violent crime. Or you can make it known to the Department of Justice that you would like to be involved in bigger cases. So a lot of times the Department of Justice is looking for local U.S. attorney's office who want to be involved in drug trafficking cases, smuggling cases, criminal enterprise cases, national security cases, cases like espionage, like the Chinese spy Yan Jiunshu, who was prosecuted here a couple of years ago. So he very much thinks that Dominic is going to have a bigger view of the job than just reactive. He thinks he'll be much more proactive.
What kind of challenges could he face in this job? Does he have all the staff he needs?
No, he does not. Both Ben Glassman and former U.S. Attorney David DeVillers and others I've spoken with in the ATF have said they don't have enough agents and they don't have enough federal prosecutors, that a lot of federal prosecutors and support staff, paralegals, have left and they've not been replaced. So, you know, it's wonderful to say that the feds are going to be taking more of these local crimes, but universally, I have heard in order to do that, they're going to need more resources from the federal government to be able to do that. They need to hire more prosecutors.
Paula, quality affordable housing is another huge issue in Cincinnati. You reported about an Over the Rhine apartment building this week. Tell us about the mom you talked with who used to live in that building.
I spoke with Denasia Shepherd. She is a young mother. She has a four-year-old daughter. She lost two newborns within a span of 2 years while living in that apartment. They both died in their sleep, unexplained, unexpectedly. And she believes that it has to do with the mold that is growing in that apartment building. It is an old brick building built in 1860, I believe. It is a apartment complex, a multifamily unit owned by Preservation for Affordable Housing, which is one of Cincinnati's largest low-income housing providers. I started looking into this nonprofit several months ago because I've gotten so many complaints from tenants, neighbors, community leaders about the poor condition of its buildings and the lack of response for making any repairs. So she is very upset, and she says that the mold is making people in the building sick. I've spoken to other tenants that lived in the, that still live where she used to live. They have complained of everything from headaches, breathing problems, rashes, diarrhea, and they say that they are very sick.
Have you seen any evidence of mold in the building?
I have not been inside the building to see, but they have, many tenants have bought home mold tests from Amazon, and they have showed me the results in petri dishes of the kinds of mold that is in their air. They've swabbed their vents, and there's a lot of mold in these petri dishes, and it's very colorful, and it doesn't look great. And then a few of them have gotten professional mold testing done of their air, as well as some of the vents. And in that unit across from that building across from Grant Park at Back and Hammer Street, the professional mold tests that I saw did show the presence of very high levels of mold in two units, and the presence of Stachybotrys, which is known as toxic black mold.
How did the owner of this building respond to these concerns that tenants and former tenants have raised about this building?
Well, I kind of got a short response that just said that they prioritize the health and safety of their residents and will be addressing these concerns in a timely way. And that was kind of it. And I did ask, you know, I did present them with specific information about the mold, and they did not address that in their response.
Has the city inspected this building?
The city has not inspected this building yet. It also, as of, you know, a few days ago, they had not. And it also had not inspected the building where Denasia currently lives, which is on Republic Street, which she believes also has mold. In the basement, her and her cousin live there in separate units. They got professional mold testing done there, which showed high levels of mold in the basement and in her cousin's air vent. The health department, they called the city for help. First, they brought their petri dishes with the mold in it to the health department and asked them to test it because they're worried. They're afraid. They're living in a dangerous place and they don't have anywhere to go. And they have children. And the health department said, we don't test petri dishes of mold. We don't do that. But we'll come out and inspect. So a health inspector came out this week, and the extent of her examination was to look for visible mold. And when she did not see any visible mold in the basement or the unit, she closed the case. And when I brought that to the city asking for an explanation, they said, well, they don't do airborne testing of mold. And our building inspector has not been there yet. But it just demonstrates the problem that tenants have in addressing these issues.
Paula, you also talked with a lawyer from Legal Aid. What did he have to say about all this?
Nick DiNardo, who's a managing attorney at the Legal Aid, he said he gets a lot of complaints about POA, about the conditions of the units. Mold is a frequent complaint. So are things like lack of working heat or appliances. He said it is very apparent that POA is not based in Cincinnati. It is based in Boston. So with out-of-town ownership, repairs are very slow to get done. The employees who do work here in Cincinnati don't have any authority to move through fixes. So they're just really slow to fix anything. You know, he wants the city to get more involved in forcing POA to make repairs, but he doesn't want POA to lose its properties, which is controversial because the tenants don't agree with that. They would like a new owner to come in. But the city is concerned because they have a huge affordable housing deficit, like 25 to 30,000 units short of what they need. So they don't want to lose, you know, these close to 1,000 units because they really can't afford to. But on the flip side, the tenants say, you know, it's not even, they don't feel like it's even safe to live here.
So what's next with all this for the tenants, for the city?
Well, when I first reported on POA in July, after two very high-profile murders had ties to their apartments in Over the Rhine, and other tenants in the West End complained about raw sewage, complained about rats, the city started meeting with POA. POA became part of the city's residential inspection program. So, which means the city will now be inspecting every single one of POA's units, and they have close to 1,000. And POA does have to pay for each inspection, and it will have to fix what the city finds. The process just started last week, and it's going to take almost 3 months to do everything. You know, one of the concerns I've heard from tenants is that they feel like POA knows in advance which units are going to be inspected. They will send out maintenance workers to put together a quick fix so the city doesn't really notice what the problem is, so that the core issues aren't being addressed.
Well, I know you'll be staying on top of this. I've been talking with WCPO9 iTeam reporter Paula Christian. Thank you so much for your time today, Paula.
Thanks, Lucy.
And WVXU General Assignment reporter Nick Swartzel is still with us to talk about additional protections for renters in Cincinnati. Thanks for sticking around, Nick.
Of course, Lucy.
Nick, City Council did take some action this week to provide more protections for renters. Tell us what Council approved.
Sure. So this particular piece of legislation is around prohibiting landlords from retaliating against tenants who complain about conditions in their rental properties. This is part of a larger raft of legislation called the Tenants' Bill of Rights that Councilmember Mika Owens and others have been spearheading. And it is designed to protect tenants who are advocating for themselves.
And so what specifically does the ordinance prohibit landlords from doing?
So a landlord under this ordinance is not allowed to threaten to raise rent, threaten evictions, or kind of close off public spaces within their rental properties for meetings among tenants when tenants are just because tenants are advocating for better conditions, maintenance, fixing other issues.
Doesn't state law in Ohio already prohibit that kind of retaliation?
It does. The Ohio Revised Code has a section prohibiting landlords from retaliating against their tenants, but it's pretty general. There's not a lot of specifics, and what this ordinance does is it makes it more specific what activities are protected that tenants can do and what landlords can't do.
This, you mentioned this is part of a broader Tenants' Bill of Rights. What else is included in that? What are some of the other
So there was ordinance that helped set up some sort of like legal representation for tenants through the Hamilton County courts. That's like help with evictions. It's help with, you know, other housing issues. That help center that exists also has information for landlords as well when they're going through that process of figuring out housing issues with their tenants. In addition, there's a tenant's sort of like handbook that the city has published that includes both like here are your rights as a tenant, but also your responsibilities as a tenant so you can have a good experience being a renter.
Well, because there are instances where tenants retaliate against landlords, maybe damaging property, those kinds of things. Can you tell us more about what help is available for landlords if they face those circumstances and what the law says about that?
Yeah, so the Help Center at the Hamilton County Courts has a whole section on their website about, like, here's what tenant responsibilities are, here's what your rights are and responsibilities are as a landlord. Ohio Revised Code says that if a tenant damages property or breaks some other laws, the landlord has the right to go after damages and legal fees, as long as those are reasonable legal fees. So, you know, landlords are also legally protected.
What's the broader goal with an ordinance like this?
So there are a lot of reports of poor housing conditions in the city, as we just heard, and as, you know, I've reported on and Becca Costello has reported on. And when you look at who gets, like, represented in the legal system, for instance, it's like 90% of landlords have legal representation and about 10% of tenants do, right? So this is a way to kind of shore up the rights, legal rights that tenants have when they're trying to get some of these conditions that we see in some of this reporting addressed. It's a way to kind of protect them from potentially being evicted just because, or you know, having their rent raised, or having their common area where they meet with the other tenants, like, locked, you know, that kind of thing. And those are things that we've heard from tenants in reporting. It's hard to verify them 100%, but there are also things that Councilmember Owen says she's heard from her constituents.
Is there a broader impact on just affordable housing and quality affordable housing that this is trying to address?
I think so. I mean, I think that this is really about holding landlords accountable, or empowering folks who live in housing who maybe don't have a whole lot of money or options to find another place to live if their place is bad, to stand up for themselves and say, hey, like, we're paying rent, we deserve habitable buildings. And so I think it's really trying to improve the condition of housing for people who are working, you know, working income people.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned that you've done so much reporting on this. Becca Costello has done so much reporting on this. Is one of the concerns just the lack of affordable housing that the city has? You know, Paula just mentioned that Nick DiNardo at Legal Aid says, oh, I don't know if we're not trying to get rid of POA exactly because there are so many there's such a need for affordable housing. And I guess if an affordable housing property owner sells it, there's no guarantee necessarily that it'll still be affordable. Is that a concern that kind of hovers over all of this?
Sure. I think it really influences all of this discussion, because what we hear time and time again from folks we talk to, who sometimes when you walk into their apartment, you can tell, like, oh, you shouldn't be living here, right? Like, what we hear is, like, there's no place else I can go that I can afford. And you hear that over and over and over again. And so folks are forced to accept or live with conditions that otherwise they'd be like, I'm out of here, I'm moving somewhere else. And so I think that that is one of the sort of, like, points of leverage that that tenants are struggling with is I don't have another option.
Well, I've been talking with WVXU General Assignment Reporter Nick Swartzel. You've done so much great reporting on all this, and I know that reporting will continue. Thanks so much for your time today, Nick.
Thanks, Lucy.
Up next, we'll hear how preserving a local watershed is helping undo the damage from the Fernald nuclear site. This is Cincinnati Edition. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. A local watershed is helping undo the damage from the old Fernald nuclear site. Joining me now to explain is WVXU senior editor and reporter Tana Weingartner. Welcome back, Tana.
I love how you punched
yes,
that.
Yes, bam, Tana Weingartner. She's here, people. Turn up the volume. We're going to hear from Tana.
If she stops laughing.
That's right. So, Tana, for people who aren't familiar with it, give us a brief history of the Fernald nuclear site.
Yeah, I mean, Fernald has just been kind of, like, all existent in my life because I'm from Butler County, which technically Fernald is in Northwest Hamilton County. But I was literally talking to somebody here at the station the other day, and I said, well, you know about Fernald, right? And I said, no, what are you talking about? So it is good to sort of give some of that backstory. It's had a lot of names, first of all, this Fernald site. I just usually go with the former Cold War era uranium processing plant. So it was built in 1951, like I said, way up in Northwest Hamilton County. County, kind of near Stricker's Grove, if you're familiar with that, right near the Butler County border. And it began turning uranium ore into uranium metal in 1952. So this was the first step in making atomic weapons, of course, and work there really peaked in the early 1960s around the Cuban Missile Crisis. At that time, there were more than 3,000 employees at Fernald. And then that started to wane a little bit. And then by the 70s, of course, there was this big public push for disarmament. Demand for processed uranium really fell, and then employment dropped to like 650. The 70s is also when questions started to be raised about public health at the site. And then by the 1980s, it's when we really started to learn the extent of the air, the water, the soil pollution at and around the site. And then in the mid-1980s, scientists confirmed that there was uranium that was contaminating the soil at Fernald, had leached into the groundwater and contaminated local drinking wells. And that, of course, is a huge problem because Fernald sits atop the Great Miami Aquifer, which is where a lot of people in the area get their drinking water.
Yeah. So when and why did it close?
So Fernald was declared a Superfund site, and it formally closed production in 1991. A Superfund site, for maybe our younger listeners, are largely manufacturing processing plants, landfills, mining sites, stuff like that, that are contaminated with massive amounts of hazardous waste. They cost billions of dollars to clean up. So while production stopped in 1991, the cleanup took another decade and a half. So a closure ceremony was held in January of 2007, and the site is now a nature preserve.
Wow. So super as in big, not
yes,
as in fantastic.
Not as fantastic.
Yes, yes. You mentioned that this sat on top of the Great Miami Aquifer. How did it damage the Great Miami Aquifer?
So you've got all this like uranium waste and other hazardous materials lying around, leaching into the ground, leaching into the soil, but also just washing into a stream that ran along this property called Paddy's Run. Now, Paddy's Run, I've recently learned this term. It's called a losing stream. And there's like a lot of scientific stuff in there. But basically, it means that the stream flows directly into the aquifer. So kind of, you know, it's above ground and then bloop, it goes below ground. So the aquifer was contaminated with uranium and other hazardous materials that were like coming literally off the site and flowing into it. And at one time, that uranium plume that was in the aquifer was 196 acres. Like, that's huge.
Oh, yeah. That seems big. That seems big. Okay. So Ohio got a settlement as partial compensation for that damage you just described. How has that money been spent?
Well, lots of settlements and judgments and whatnot surrounding Fernald, of course. The one I focused on for the story that we aired this week was for $13.7 million. That's what Ohio got. And a group called the Fernald Natural Resource Trustees are kind of in charge of, you know, sending that money around. So they partnered with the Three Valley Conservation Trust in 2010 to use some of that money to protect the Paddy's Run watershed. Paddy's Run being, again, that creek that runs along Fernald and then about 5 miles north. So the idea is to improve the water flowing from Paddy's Run into the aquifer.
Tell us more about the Paddy's Run conservation project. How long has that been around? What impact has that work had?
Right. So again, they got the money in 2010, I think this was. Yeah. And then the plan is to clean up this, it's like basically 5 miles from the watershed runs. And the area along Paddy's Run from where it ends at Fernald up to its headwaters, and where the headwaters are, is now a park, a Butler County Metro Park. It's called Salamander Run Metro Park, and it's up in Morgan Township on Lehigh Road.
Salamanders, that sounds like a Tanimal reference is coming up.
Yeah.
Well, so, what kind of difference has all this made to the water quality?
Yeah, so I should mention, like, the project has already protected more than 4,800 acres by creating these conservation easements. These easements keep natural areas natural. They keep farmland. Like, if you're already a farmer there and you go ahead and have an easement, it just keeps that area from being developed. So it helps create a buffer around the stream. And so, for example, Salamander Run Metro Park was a farm. It got converted into a park. And all of that helps improve the water quality from running off the land into Paddy's Run. And I think what you were asking me was like, how is all that water difference made, you know, help the water quality? Yeah. So it's really made a big difference. I talked with Steve Gordon, who's with Three Valley Conservation Trust. He basically described the water in Patty's Run when they first started going up there. I think 2016, maybe. Apologies if that's wrong. I can't remember just off the top of my head. But he said it looked like chocolate milk because of all the soil and all of the other stuff, you know, just like running off the land. You know, it'd rain, you'd have a big rain event. All this gunk would go into the aquifer. And of course, right, that's bad because that's then into the watershed, into the creek. And then the creek runs into the aquifer. So obviously, that's no good. Now, also, again, as I was saying, Patty's Run is this losing stream. It goes straight into the aquifer. And to ensure that you're getting clean water pushed into the aquifer, you've got to clean up all the land there. But they do also have these containment wells and some groundwater extraction systems in the aquifer where they're constantly removing the groundwater from the aquifer. They pull out the remaining uranium because there is some uranium still in there. About 69 acres is the site of the plume, which is much significantly smaller than 196 that it used to be. But it's like a slow process, right? So there's the unsaturated part of the aquifer. And I know Tom Schneider, if he's listening, is like, your science is terrible, Tana. But basically, they kind of let
Tom, show us some grace.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So they kind of let this unsaturated section of the aquifer fill up over, you know, maybe a year or two. And then they pump out that water and they clean it. They take out the remaining uranium. So it's like a whole flushing system. And the uranium that is in there is like at low levels. So it's considered safe under the federal drinking water standard.
Now, your reporting also talked about prairies and wetlands and vernal pools that are now on this land that
at Salamander Run.
Yeah, Salamander Run that weren't there before because
it was farmland.
Yeah, so
now they were probably there before it was the farmland. Yeah. Right.
So why is all that important?
Right. So they are helping to do this work of cleaning up the water. Right. So having native prairies keeps the soil where it belongs, so it's not getting washed into the creek. And then having wetlands really helps because they help remove pollutants from the surface water. That helps control, they also help control floods, keeping again all that gunk out of there. They're sort of like sponges. So, and then of course, also there you've got riparian forests. So you've got all these trees. That's really great in the park because that helps again also keep the land how it's supposed to be and keep all the stuff where it's supposed to be, and making sure that clean water gets into the creek and then ultimately the aquifer.
That makes sense. So Salamander Run Park, does that mean there are salamanders there? What kind of critters do we have living there now?
Well, all kinds of good stuff. And of course, my favorite, salamanders. There are lots of birds. I don't have the number offhand, but a prominent birder has been there and counted, you know, like an absurd number of birds, which is good, absurdly good. But as you said, they're salamanders. So they weren't there, obviously, when they started doing this work. But there is a nearby Butler County Metro Park called Indian. It just went right out of my head. There's a nearby park.
Yep.
I love it. It's a great place to hike. Don't go there because I don't want it to be too busy. That's why I'm not telling you the name. But it also has salamanders. I've done some previous reporting on salamanders from said park. And so they went up with permission and transplanted some of the salamanders from that park to this park, to the wetlands and the vernal pools that they have created as part of, you know, changing it from being a farm to being a Butler County Metro Park. And so here's why salamanders are important. If you've ever heard me do any story on salamanders, you should probably know this. They're an indicator species because they're really susceptible to bad habitat. So if the water quality is garbage, the salamanders won't survive there. They won't thrive. You won't find them. They have salamanders at Salamander Run. This transplant worked. So that means that at least the water at the headwaters of Patty's Run is clean and doing good.
Oh, so salamanders are like the canary in the coal mine.
Precisely.
Okay.
They're the salamander in the uranium plant.
Yeah. What does this, does this conservation project still have the money that it needs to continue this work? We talked about this settlement at the top of our conversation.
Going back to, I believe, 2010? So after 15 years or so, the Fernald settlement dollars supporting the Patty's Run Conservation Project, they are dwindling. Steve Gordon, who I mentioned earlier, says most of what's left is just going to go toward maintaining the properties that they've bought. So they've they've used the money to buy up these easements all along the watershed. So, you know, if a farmer has a farm there, They purchased an easement along, you know, on their land, which means that if it's the land can't change from the time that the easement was put in place. So if it was a farm, it can stay a farm, but it also means you can't sell your farmland to become a subdivision or some sort of plant there. So, but yeah, that money is about gone. They're going to use it to take care of the easements that they've already purchased.
Are more easements needed?
Yeah. So they don't have the whole of the watershed is not protected yet with these easements. So they're applying for grants and, you know, other funding sources, but those are also, to use a water pun, drying up. So now on the upside, Three Valley Conservation Trust does say, you know, they've done such a good job here. The work that they're trying to do and the way they're doing it is, you know, the news is spreading to other farmers, and now they're having property owners that are coming to them looking to donate their land as easements. You know, Steve told me a really great story about sitting on his, this isn't in the story, but sitting, you know, at an older gentleman's farm. They're out on the patio, the porch, and he, you know, I'm imagining it was like at sunset, and the farmer is looking out over his farmland. He's just decided to put it into an easement. And, you know, he basically said something like, if heaven's anything like my view here, I'm ready to go.
Aw, so, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
So how has the land at Fernald changed? I mean,
yeah, so it's a big difference. You know, this Salamander Run is the pictures that you'll see if you go to WVXU.org. But the land at Fernald itself is now a nature preserve. And that opened, 10 so years ago. And there is still hazardous waste on the site. There are silos on site. Those will remain. I mean, just thousands and tons of uranium waste were taken off the site. They were trucked off the site. They were taken by train off the site. I was actually at Fernald as a WMUB reporter the day the last train load of waste was hauled off to, I think it went to Utah maybe. But now it does look like a preserve. It's interesting though, you'll see a lot of areas that don't have trees. You can't plant the trees over the areas where the waste is being preserved in silos or where the aquifers wells are.
Okay. Well, I have been talking with the fabulous WVXU senior editor and reporter, Tana Weingartner. Tana, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Lucy.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical director is Carlos Lopez-Cornu. And if you miss our program live, you can find Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to go to our website and RSVP for our politics show. It's going to be happening at our new building, September 24th. You don't want to miss it. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.